But there are two key points when dads are really important. That one is the preschool age, when they first go into the world beyond the family and go to nursery, preschool, whatever. The other is teenagehood. Because both are transitions into the world beyond the family. Teenagehood is when you're starting to really separate from your parents. Your key attachment figures tend to no longer be your parents. They tend to be your peers. And you're starting to really develop your identity. And we know from the early years preschool studies that, yeah, executive function, for example, the dad seems to be the key parent when it comes to the development of executive function in their child. And we know that from the age of about three, it's really, really critical. So executive function is things like attention, emotional inhibition, things like that. And it's really the fundamental cognitive skills that enable you to interact with other people and be somebody in society. And if you don't get good executive function going forward, you can struggle with mental health, you can struggle with social anxiety and things like that.
Welcome to the show, I'm Joe Horton. On the Guild of Dads show, we unwrap weekly the incredible stories, skills and expertise of the world's most captivating dads and experts, along with topics that will captivate you. Fascinating individuals, writers, entrepreneurs and anthropologists, professors and psychologists. Today, I find out about you. Well, not personally, you in particular, but dads. I'm finding out about how you have evolved to be a dad, the attributes, characteristics, and skills that evolution has given you to carry out this important task. Every conversation we have translates the experience and expertise of our guests into practical knowledge you can use to better understand yourself as a dad and in the process improve your physical health, mental health, relationships, career and the way in which you show up to the world as a role model to the next generation. We also cover tricky subjects from all angles and viewpoints to give you a new and different perspective. Now, me personally, I've been fascinated by evolution for some time now and how we have adapted to live in the world in which we do. Indeed, previous guests on the podcast, I've explored with them in terms of how our brain has adapted to the modern world or not, as the case may be. However, today, I look specifically at dads and how our biology is uniquely adapted to fulfill this most important of roles for all men. My guest today is evolutionary anthropologist, writer and broadcaster, Dr. Anna Machin. I find out about how Anna's own traumatic birth and seeing the effect it had on her husband piqued her curiosity around researching further into the role of dads and what happens to men when they become fathers. Her amazing discoveries around how evolution adapts mums and dads to work in a way to complement each other and the incredible biological changes which happen under the bonnet when men become dads. We also find out about the societal shift going on right now, the crossroads dads now find themselves at, and the way in which mums and dads' relationships impact your children when they arrive into the world. If you ever wonder how some of my amazing guests get to where they are in life, the athletes, the entrepreneurs, those making a massive impact on the world, I can tell you that pretty much all of them follow a very deliberate plan or system of some kind. This is exactly what I do too, and I'm revealing how you can implement a plan and system in your own life completely free in my ebook, The Dad Blueprint, over at guildofdads.com/dad. That's guildofdads.com/dad. Incidentally, many of the people I interview on this show will be leveraging the power of similar systems to radically level up their lives and transform into the men and dads they always wanted to be. So you will be in amazing company. And now to my conversation with Dr. Anna Machin. Anna, welcome to the Guild of Dads podcast.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
It's an absolute pleasure, and I'm glad you've joined me today because I grabbed a copy of your book recently, The Life of Dad, which I'm going to show up here for the people that can see this on video. And it's been absolutely fascinating because my wife said to me over the weekend, she said, well, what's the book like? And I said, it's interesting. It's a journey through daddom, but also it's kind of like reading the pages of a David Attenborough book at the same time.
Excellent.
But it was thoroughly enjoyable to read because it really did kind of captivate my kind of fascination with how we've got to where we are in terms of the evolution of dad and where we first started. But what interested me more so was, what was your inspiration behind actually writing the book in the first place? How did you come to writing a book as a mum about the experience of dad?
Well, I wrote the book as a consequence of a research program that I started after I had my first child. So really, it's the inspiration behind the research program, I suppose, which was my own husband's experience when we had our first child together. And his experience was very much, I mean, I think it's the normal story for couples going forward and having a baby, is that, you know, you decide to have a child together. It's very much a team decision. You do everything together. You go to antenatal classes together. You plan everything together. And you, as a couple, see it very much as you both going forward to having a child. And then when I went into hospital to have my daughter, it wasn't a particularly easy birth. It was quite traumatic. And there was a risk that I would die and my baby would die. And at that point, it very suddenly became me having a baby. And my husband was very much left as a bystander. And what happened was, I lost a lot of blood. It was very traumatic. And after I had her, they came to me in the ward and said, well, you know, do you want some counselling? Do you want to talk about what happened? Do you want us to explain? And my husband, who literally had watched everything, whereas I'd passed out, to be honest, I couldn't remember that much, wasn't offered anything at all. And he was really deeply traumatised by it. You know, even years afterwards, he couldn't talk about the birth of our daughter without being really upset, emotionally really, really upset. I thought, I got quite cross, because I was like, hold on a second. It's like he's just this bag carrier in the corner of the room, and this awful thing has happened to him, and he's not been given any support at all. So I kind of, as an anthropologist, when I went back to work when my daughter was about a year old, I thought, I'm just going to have a quick look and see what we know about fathers, because obviously the whole point of anthropology is it's about the study of human behaviour and the important roles we all play in human society. And obviously being a dad is a really important role. And there was nothing. There was literally nothing. There was lots of stuff on the impact that absent fathers have on their children's development, but nothing about actually the majority of dads who are sticking around and doing the job. And so I thought, right, well, this is, you know, outrageous. So I decided to set up my first research program, which was a really open, broad research program, just following, at the time, just 15 dads, and just simply asking the question, what happens to them? Mm-hmm. What happens to them when they become a father, biologically, psychologically, practically, all these sort of things? And then as I was doing that, and I was going to visit all my dads and collect data from them and, you know, get some blood from them and all these horrible things I used to do for them, they used to say, well, you know, what are the results? What are the results? And I was like, well, and they were so fascinated about what might be happening to them. And I just thought, well, we have to write this down. I have to, like, make sure it's not restricted to academic journals, that actually I write it. And so from then on, I always had this wish that I was going to write it all down, not just my work in the end, but everybody's work. Because as we went through sort of the decade, more and more people came on board and started asking these questions. And that's what The Life of Dad really is. It's a summary of everything we know about what it is, what happens to you when you become a dad. Because I think there are books on the market, but either they are quite jokey, and that's fine, that's an area, or they're more about dad's role as a supporter and, you know, what's going to happen during birth and all this thing. And again, all really needed, but nothing really that just said, what happens to you? What are your concerns? What are, you know, how have other men experienced this amazing transition to being a dad? And so really, that's what the book was about. It's very much for dads to really understand and hopefully maybe try and explain some of the things they're feeling or experiencing, I suppose.
And one of the things that I really enjoyed about it as well is some of the information that you read and receive as a dad, and particularly in that whole period where, before you're about to have children, and that period afterwards when you have like health visitors around and midwives around and stuff, and that there is, and I don't know whether this is necessarily intended, there is a very patronising tone towards it. And that was one of the refreshing things I found about your book, was that there was not an ounce of a patronising tone in it whatsoever, which I think, you know, taps into what you say about how the discussion is had with dads in this kind of day and age, because there is this very much, I think there is a shift going on right now between this kind of what I would call Homer Simpson hapless, helpless man type character that has kind of been portrayed in the, and you touch upon this in your book, in the kind of popular TV and press, and kind of almost sneering at guys as if to say, well, you're kind of useless. You don't know anything. You're just here to come and kind of provide the financial assistance, but actually we don't really need you. You're not a help at all, sort of thing. when that's not actually the experience of a lot of dads, is it really, Anna?
No, and that was the idea, is that actually when you look at our representations of fathers in society, and as you said, yeah, the Homer Simpson, the daddy pig, useless, you know, puts the nappy on backwards, can't operate the washing machine, all these sorts of useless ideas we have about fathers. And the actual reality of if you actually talk to particularly a new dad, it's just, that's not the reality. And we've built this stereotype of this useless male who's very much the secondary parent, can't be left on his own with the children without a long list of everything he needs to do. And it's just a joke, because what I wanted to say to dads was, you are, because I'm an evolutionary anthropologist, you are as evolved, as biologically primed and instinctive a parent as the mum is. The only reason we haven't known this before is nobody bothered to look. So the fact that now we've bothered to look, we can say that, and we can say that's an absolute fact. So this idea that mum's the gold standard of parenting and she instinctively knows what to do, which is an absolute joke. I mean, I didn't instinctively know what to do. is not true. Both parents are as biologically primed as each other, and both parents have to, you know, learn on the job as well. You know, so it's the same. It's the same experience in that sense.
Yeah.
Whether you're a dad or a mum.
Yeah. And it's funny you say that, because I was talking to a lot of the guests that I have on the podcast are relationship experts. So I get the perspective of this from a different angle vis-a-vis people trying to improve their relationships. Mm. And one of the things that John Gray said to me, author of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, he said that dads are very much different in the sense that, you know, and he used the example of going to the seaside with the kids. You know, mum will be very much like, have they got their coats? Have they got their food? Mm. Have they got their drinks? And he said and one of the things he pointed out to me was this notion that dads bring something very different to the parenting experience, in the sense that it will be okay. It doesn't matter if we haven't got coats, we're still going to have fun. It doesn't matter if we've not got everything perfectly together. We'll get a takeaway lunch, or we'll get this, or we'll get that. But the way in which dads operate is a lot more kind of on the hoof, a lot more kind of responsive in a lot of cases, and a lot more kind of spontaneous. But then that plays into the whole problem solving experience that kids have of seeing, well, okay, dad is able to think on his feet and think how we're going to overcome this now. How are we going to overcome this now? Which are essential life skills as they go into adolescence and adulthood.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the things, you know, we found out from the research, is that mums and dads, while there's an overlap in the role, very much so. So when we look at the empathising, nurturing, caretaking, risk detection side of parenting, you know, both parents are very much primed to do that. You know, that's that absolute essential keep the kid alive kind of job. Mm-hmm. But then when we look at the sort of embellishments on the role, they are evolved to be different. And that's understandable, because evolution, when you look at how evolution works, it doesn't like what we call redundancy. So it doesn't cause two people to evolve to have exactly the same job if that's not necessary for the end goal. Mm-hmm. And so with children, actually, the fact that mum and dad do things differently is really important to their development, because by having those two different roles and representing life in different ways and dealing with life in different ways and maybe promoting different developmental areas of those children, then that child gets the entire package, essentially. And so that's why they've evolved to be different. So yeah, mums are much more practical, they are more risk averse generally than dads are. They are more into that, and they are more maybe cuddly nurturing to a certain extent, whereas dads, it's very much about pushing, stimulating development, pushing that developmental boundary, introducing the child to risk, introducing the child to challenge, introducing the child to failure, and scaffolding their ability to deal with those. Mm. And as you say, those are really important life skills. So in a way, I always say that dads are the gateway to the world. So they are the ones who are going to give those really important resilience skills to that child, so that when they go out into the world and they hit an obstacle, they don't collapse. You know, they pick themselves up, they dust themselves off, and they go, right, I'm going to confront this obstacle, I'm going to surmount it, and I'm going to be okay. And that, as you know, is really, really important. If you don't give your child that, they're going to find the outside world a very stressful place. So dads and mums do have this sort of complementary rather than mirroring. They don't mirror each other, they complement each other, and it's really important. I mean, things say, obviously, people always say to me at this point, yes, but what if you've only got one of them? If you've only got one of them, then the human brain's amazing and it adapts, and you will, you know, a single parent can do all that if required. But when we talk about the couple, the heterosexual couple, then that's generally what we will see between them. And it's evolved to be that way.
Yeah. And there's one point in your book, which I think you call, I think it's around the word efficiency, how evolution works in quite an efficient way. So it doesn't double up the jobs that need doing. No. It actually apportions the jobs and builds those characteristics in from an evolutionary point of view into mum and into dad, so that they both complement each other. And I think you used the word synchronicity or something like that.
Yeah,
that
so right? There's a synchrony in the way they work, but they don't. It's not an imitation. They don't imitate. So when you look at particularly, even if you look at like a primary caretaking dad, who society would have seen as taking over the mum's role, he's not a male mum. He doesn't do it like a mum. He does it like a dad, and that's really important that he still does it that way, because that's how he's evolved to be. So I always say, you know, when people, you know, sort of criticize dads and say, well, they're not doing it right. Well, actually, what you're saying is they're not doing it the way mum wants it to be done. And that's the point. That's the way mum does it. And actually, the way dad does it, that difference is really, really important. And actually, it teaches your child about difference, about people's characters are different and they do things in different ways. And that flexibility of being able to deal with that is again, really important.
One thing I wanted to ask you, just as I was reading through the book, and when you mentioned that, it's kind of tweaked my brain a bit. This whole notion of mums and dads being different and men and women being different. There seems to be a push right now within the kind of, I suppose you could call it, social constructionist side of society to kind of homogenize men and women. So that men should be more like women, and if they don't behave more like women, then it's a fundamental flaw in how they are as a man and stuff. How do you think this is kind of playing into this whole dynamic of if dad should be more like mum and do things the way mum does? And because when I speak to, again, touching on relationship experts, they've said that this is beginning to creep into relationships whereby there is a slight polarization between men and women, which is being influenced by what's going on in the kind of wider media. What do you think about that?
The trouble we have is what influences how humans behave. There is that biological evolutionary underpinning, and then there's all those societal and cultural ideas about how it should be. And it's about trying to untangle all that. And we go through, we're going through a period at the moment where it is all about sort of everyone being the same and there being a spectrum. And there is a spectrum. You know, these are statistical averages. You will get a dad who, for example, is very huggy, nurturing and risk averse. You know, it is a spectrum. But it's a really difficult area because ultimately, you know, I don't believe in biological determinism. So it's not like, you know, yes, you are a bloke and therefore you're going to do it this way. No, that's not true. But at the same time, there are innate parts of us which are incredibly ancient. And, you know, if you think human fathers evolved 500,000 years ago, that's, you know, that's quite a heck of history that's gone into who you are. And fundamentally changing that basic biological drive is pretty nigh on impossible. So it's trying to sort of balance those two things of our societal ideas about who we should be and how we feel we should be, and that's that biological innate drive. Now you can overcome that, you know, I mean, all these ideas about, you know, how sexual harassment and stuff, you know, if you look at the way males treat females in the animal kingdom, it's horrendous. You know, but we are intelligent beings and we have overcome that, and we have said, no, you do not behave that way, which is the right thing to say. And it's a really tricky area. And that's why I'm kind of struggling a little bit to answer your question, because my work has been hijacked at times by very far right, quite strongly religious people who say, right, there we go. She's saying men should be men and women should be women. And that's what evolution says. And there's no changing that. And that's not what I'm saying. That's misunderstanding the complexity of being human.
Yeah.
That we have these innate drives, which do mean that men, dads and mums have evolved to be different. But on top of that, you have so many layers of culture and society and history and politics and religion, which will mold that. And that's why being human is so incredibly complex, is that we've got all this other stuff on top, which then you know, can tell you exactly to go against your natural drive. So, for example, I mean, I'm writing another book at the moment, and it's about love, and it's about expressions of love. And there's one culture where it's actually seen as incredibly bad for a mother to show their own child nurture. If they show their own child affection and nurture, that will bring the evil eye upon the child. So they will show affection and nurture to other people's children, but not their own. Now, can you imagine how hard that is for that mother to go against that instinctive drive to nurture her child? But the religious teachings are that no, to do that will spoil the child, so you don't do it. Now, that is a woman overcoming her nurturing instinct, her parental instinct to nurture, because of what society dictates.
Interesting.
And so, do you see, it's incredibly complicated how ultimately we will behave as parents.
Yeah, yeah. And it's. I think there's always going to be that, like you say, that kind of, I don't know if it's a, compromise is the right word, but it's navigating the kind of disconnect between the societal norms and what your kind of, your natural state of being is. And one thing I've noticed with a lot of men is that not all, but a lot of them, when they begin to kind of align with their kind of, the way they naturally are, it removes a lot of conflict within them in terms of having to be a certain way. Not all guys, but I think a large majority of guys.
Yeah.
And I think that what I've noticed is that some are kind of torn between what they should be versus what they are kind of naturally are. And when they kind of align with what they naturally are and, you know, and do things that are in alignment with who they are, it has a massively beneficial effect to both their relationship with mum, but also how they bond with their kids and all this kind of stuff. So,
yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, that's all about, I think it's important for both parents to be comfortable with the parenting identity they choose. And I'm very all for sort of not saying, because I always get asked by journalists, what's the best dad? Well, you know, and it's just a ludicrous question. Because for a start, it's highly environmentally dependent what the best dad is. But also, I think we should all be open to look at our circumstances, look at the partnership we're in, whatever, and become the parent that we're most comfortable with.
Hmm.
It's not about being something that you're not. You know, if actually, you know, so I talk a lot in the book about rough and tumble play and the importance of that to the bond between children and fathers in the West. But if you're not a rough and tumble dad, that doesn't mean you're doing something else. Maybe you're reading a story or doing a jigsaw or painting a picture or whatever. And that's just as valuable. And actually that's what I wanted to be able to say to fathers partly with the book is be the dad you want to be. Think about, and that's why I say, you know, those 9 months of pregnancy are really important, because actually it's that time for you and your partner to really think about, who do we want to be as parents? How do we want to interact with each other? Because there is no prescription that says you have to be a certain way.
Mm.
The best thing for a child is that they are brought up by a parent or parents who's comfortable in their own skin.
Because
children are very sensitive.
Yeah, yeah. And I think one thing that I notice a lot with particularly dads and particularly men is that, in terms of, because a lot of what I do is kind of around, you know, self-improvement, self-development. It's self-development for dads, if you like. And one thing I notice certainly is that when dads are firing on all cylinders, everyone glows in that light. Mum does, children do. And it's kind of, it's a kind of win-win situation. You know, dads that feel good about themselves and, you know, are doing stuff constructive in the world and they're enjoying their lives and they're finding fulfillment and purpose and meaning. That has like a carryover effect into kind of
exactly.
Everything.
Exactly, it's a spillover effect. I mean, the opposite of that is if we don't have happy dads, there's also a spillover effect, and it's really interesting. It's kind of called the fathering vulnerability hypothesis, and it's that dads tend to look at their family in a different way to mums. So mums look at the family as a series of dyads, as a series of couples. So there's the relationship she has with her partner, but you know, then she has a relationship with each kid. And that's how she sees it. So if she's, let's say, unhappy with her partner, that doesn't really spill over into the relationship she has with her kids or the wider family. Whereas dads actually see the family at three different levels, individually, so there's lots of individuals, then as those couples within the family, those dyads, and then as the family whole. And for that reason, if dads are unhappy in one relationship, it tends to spill over into the other ones. So actually what we really do need is a content, empowered, happy dad. Because if we have that, then the family itself tends to function better. Hmm. And that's not saying, you know, the most important thing is dads be happy and everyone else can be miserable. That's not what we're saying. But that it's important to understand how, if a dad is not happy, and we see it again and again with maybe fathers who have depression or whatever, is they withdraw from the entire family. Hmm. And they separate themselves off. And that's not, you know, that's what we don't want, because that's not good for the for the functioning or the health of that family.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of dads, when I read that, I could relate to that a lot, because I was reading it and I was thinking, yeah, when I'm not feeling so great generally, or if I've had an argument with my wife, generally, it's not that I just want to not be anywhere near her. It's generally, yeah, I just want to be away. I just want to be away from the situation. And I think a lot of the challenge, I think, for dads is that processing is processing and then returning to the family unit once you've had that kind of processing time, whether it's journaling or meditating or going for a walk or whatever it's going to be. But I think it's that's where that whole processing point really comes into kind of fruition, before you kind of return and you kind of, it's that discord and then returning to it, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Sort of sorting out in your own mind and then coming back into the family. But I think it's really important to understand that difference between how a dad views things and how a mum views things, because it's not the same. Mm. And that's why, you know, I'm a very big advocate, and so is Mark Williams, who you've spoken to, for dad-specific support and dad-specific, when we talk about mental health, dad-specific diagnostic measures, because dads are not mums. Mm. They operate and they think in a different way. And therefore, we need to be very aware that the support we give to them isn't just, oh, we've given that to mums and it works, let's give it to dads. That's not, no, you need to be very aware of what specifically fathers need.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And I find that one of the things where that comes up a lot as well is, it, particularly in relationships, is I think that dads and men often want to kind of be the fixers of things. And one of the things that I often say to dads when they're kind of in conflict with their partners is, your wife doesn't always want you to fix stuff. No, sometimes she just wants you to listen. And sometimes you need to be able to say, do you want me to fix, honey, or do you want me to listen?
Want me to listen
at the moment?
Yeah. And exactly. And, you know, men put a lot of pressure on themselves to be the one that sorts everything out. It's that problem-solving side of things, isn't it?
Yeah.
But sometimes, actually, it is just a case of just stopping and listening. And it's the same with parenting. Yeah. Sometimes you can't fix it. And it's actually, just about listening and hugging and nurturing.
Mm.
You know, and being that person who just helps everything pass.
Yeah. Yeah,
but it can be difficult, and I think that's what men find at this current stage in sort of the evolution of the dad's role, is we're at that stage now where, you know, men are aware that they want to be more hands-on and they want to move away from that breadwinning stereotype, and that's absolutely great. But they're at that stage now, I think, where maybe women were a little bit in the 80s with the idea of having it all, that, you know, men are still at that position where they're still seen, though, as the primary breadwinner. And you've got to be the primary breadwinner, but you've also got to be the at-home nurturing dad. And that puts a lot of pressure on men because they have this problem-solving, kind of in a way, white knight, I'm going to rescue everything, tendency. So they're trying to be brilliant at work and brilliant at home, and actually there aren't enough hours in the day.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that again is a current really big tension for men in terms of, you know, they're at that stage which I think mums were at, or still maybe some mums are, where you're thinking, I'm not actually doing a good enough job at work or at home because there's just too much to do, you know. And it's that idea of balance and trying to convince the powers that be that we give men proper paternity rights and we give them proper fathering rights and we see them as a co-parent rather than a secondary parent. And therefore, if they're given the same rights as women are in terms of parental leave and flexible working, then in fact, you know, that takes that burden off them a little bit.
Mm. And I think there's
a long way to go.
Yeah. And I think there's a generational crossroads at the minute as well. And I talk to a lot of dads my age. I'm 41 now. God, I feel old now. I'm 41. And so I sort of talk to a lot of guys my age who are kind of typically children of baby boomers. And, you know, that whole generation was very kind of, work, did the same career for the whole of, you know, same job for the whole of their lives, and then retired, and then life started when they retired and often didn't start if they passed away early. And so I think our generation are kind of looking at it thinking, well, hang on a minute, do I want to work my socks off, not really see my kids, and then actually get to retirement, and then actually I wished I'd have done that when I was younger, and sort of life's passed us by and stuff. So there does seem to be a shift at the minute, and I think the lockdown and also the pandemic is actually hastening that shift, because you know, a lot of guys are having to work from home, and the whole argument with, you know, flexi and working from home from the employer's side is kind of being diminished a little bit, because it's been proven that people can actually work from home. So it's an interesting crossroads, I think, that we're at, both as, you know, both in terms of kind of our parents' generation, how different it is, but also kind of in terms of, you know, breaking out of this kind of, what we've discussed as this kind of Homer Simpson kind of persona that dads have been given. So
no, it is, and you're right, it's an absolute crossroads. And I think I say in the book, you know, we're at that crossroads and we need to decide, are we going to go forward or are we going to carry on with this route, which actually is better for children, of empowering dads, supporting dads to be at home more and to be co-parents, or are we just going to think, nah, and get dragged back to the 1950s? And that's kind of where we are. And I think, you know, I think we are going to carry on going forward, because I think the voices of men are becoming stronger in terms of wanting that. But we're at the mercy, in a way, of governments and policies and politics in terms of whether they're actually going to be given the support to do that. Because when you do give dads the support to be at home more, you know, you properly, for example, financially support it, men grab it. You know, we know that from, you know, Quebec in Canada, where they have proper funded paternity leave. We know that from, you know, Sweden. We know that from so many different places, that if you do it properly, you don't just pay lip service to it, then men will grab it.
I'm going to jump in here very quickly. If you have listened for any period of time, you will know that I place a massive value in having a group of other men around you to elevate what you think is possible for yourself. I want to tell you about the exclusive brotherhood I've put together called the Dad Circle, which is a group of dads committed to improving themselves in a number of areas in order to become the men and dads they always wanted to be. Not just this, but hardwired into the fabric of this brotherhood are a number of features, including weekly Zoom calls, monthly topics, challenges and assignments, together with a growing library of resources, fitness and mental challenges. You'll get just the accountability that you're looking for when you're surrounded by a group of other men looking to level up and go on a journey in exactly the same way. If this resonates with you and you would like to find out more, head on over to www.thedadscircle.com/join. That's thedadscircle.com/join. And I think, there is this disconnect, and there is a political disconnect. And I agree with you. I think that there's always makes me kind of chuckle, in the sense that, like, International Men's Mental Health Day was before Christmas, and everyone was going, right, men need to talk, focus on men's mental health, and all this kind of stuff that gets respectfully sometimes parrot fashion out from the powers that be and whatever.
Then I read the next day
that a Conservative politician stood up in Parliament to call for a men's minister and stuff like this. And then the debate is shortened, and then he's mocked, sneered and jeered at for having the audacity to even mention it. And you're just like, come on. And this is, I hate to say it, but this was coming from a lot of female MPs. And you're like, come on, really? You know, you need to gravitate above this conversation a little bit. And I don't want to get too political with you, Anna, but I think this is part and parcel of this disconnect. You know, it seems as if they want to curry favour, saying, yeah, we're all for men's mental health, but when it actually comes to discussing it, it's like, oh well, no, you've not actually got any rights to say anything because you're a man.
Yeah, and that's the problem we have. It's kind of that, and you see it in other areas of, like, well, women for so long, and, you know, God, you know, I mean, yes, and I get attacked again by some branches of feminism, but for women for so long have had it hard, are still having it hard, but their mantra is, well, we've had it hard, so you can have it hard. And that's just that lacks humanity, that argument, I think. What you say is, yes, it's been awful for a long time for women. It still is. So, and we're understanding now that men are in that position with their parenting. So actually, why don't we use that empathy that we've learned and support them? And what gets me about that argument as well from women is that ultimately, if you empower men and you support them to be more involved fathers, it benefits women because you have more equality in the home in terms of domestic responsibilities. As a woman, if you can say to a woman, yeah, let's share that maternity leave. You do the first 6 months, your husband does the second 6 months properly supported. You get to go back to work sooner. So you don't have that career penalty, which a lot of women carry because they've had children. You influence, hopefully, the gender pay gap by reducing it slightly because you have less time out. So ultimately, we actually lead to a more equal life in the workplace for women.
Mm-hmm.
It's all intertwined. We're not these separate entities where, and also it makes me really cross where it like, oh no, there's only a finite amount of empathy to go around. So if you give men empathy, then there's less for women. Now, that might be true for financial things, but it shouldn't be true just for the basic, I get you're having a crap time. I get that you do have issues with mental health. Let's support you with that. Hmm. You know, we don't have, there is not a pie of empathy where if, you know, we give it to one person, the other person doesn't get it. And that's kind of that reductionist argument that sometimes you get from for certain women and certain sectors of society.
Men
have had it great for so long. It's their turn to have it a bit rubbish, which isn't very grammatical, but you know what I mean? And yeah. I just think it's a really reductionist argument that's lacking in humanity.
Yeah. And I see it in what I'm doing. And, you know, I'm not the only one, as you know, I'm not the only one doing something for dads. There's a ton of different organizations.
Yeah.
And one of the things that frequently we get is anyone in this kind of sphere gets is, oh, so it's all about dads, is it? It's all about men. And I'm like, no, actually, no, it's not. It's about building better men and better dads, which impact everyone exponentially.
It really does.
And a lot of people just can't get their heads around it. It's just, it's always a them and us sort of situation. You know what I mean?
It is. And I always have that, you know, when I, for example, when we talk about male mental health, and obviously my area of mental health for men is more sort of pre and postnatal mental health. But when I, you know, so when I say to women, we need to support men in this, and they go, oh, you know, you get some people who go, well, they should just pull themselves together. They didn't give birth. They didn't, you know, do all that. And I go, okay, let's just say we don't care about the men. They can go and suffer. That's fine. But the fact that your husband or whoever it is has depression will impact your child's development unless he is properly supported. It will impact your family and your relationship. So actually, all of that is going to suffer. And going forward, let's say that your child is developmentally affected by the father having depression. Going forward, society, there will be a cost to society of that, whether it's just financial, because that child might need mental health support going forward, whatever it might be. So actually, we all share the burden of that.
Mm.
And that is why, forget dad, that is why we need to support this man.
Mm.
Because we're all interrelated. We don't all exist as separate entities. What happens to one of us impacts all of us. And therefore, yeah, it's really important that it, just from that point of view, that you support men.
Mm, yeah, it's wise words. Wise words. But it is a discussion that needs to be had, definitely, most definitely. One of the things that I want to touch upon, which absolutely fascinated me when I was reading through your book, and it's kind of mind-blowing, is the hormonal changes that occur in dads pre and post birth. And I wonder whether you could explain what actually happened, because I was, you know, most people know about, have heard of dopamine, oxytocin, and these different hormones. What does actually happen to a dad
when he becomes right? So the really big one is what happens to your testosterone. Everyone knows that in a woman, estrogen, progesterone are going all over the place when she's pregnant, when she becomes a mum. And the equivalent hormones, obviously, in a man are testosterone. It's a sex hormone. And what happens when you become a dad for the first time is your testosterone level drops. And it never returns to pre-birth levels or pre-parenthood levels unless you don't see your child. So let's say you don't see your child at all, then it will return. But if you remain in contact with your child, you don't even have to be living with the child, but you remain in contact with them, then it will remain at that low level. And it's really critically important for preparing that man to become a father, because testosterone is really, really great. It is the hormone that makes men men, and it's important when you're competing for a mate, because it makes you more competitive, but it also makes you more attractive. So men with higher testosterone tend to be more attractive to women. So it's brilliant. But once you've got that mate, we then, and once your mate is pregnant, we then need you to stop looking at the horizon for the next mating opportunity and focus on that partner and that baby. And so the testosterone's got to go. It's called the challenge hypothesis. And we see it in all mammals, reptiles, birds who have infesting fathers, the testosterone drops. Because then that means the father is less inclined to disappear off and find another mate and will shift their focus from the outside world to the family and look after the baby. And we also know that men with low testosterone, regardless of whether they have children or not, are more empathetic, more motivated to care for children. So even if you're a man and you don't have any children, but you happen to, you know, be around children, you will be more empathetic to their needs. And so it's really critical that, that testosterone drop happens. And it can be up to a third.
Okay.
So it can go down a long way. But it's the basis. It's what I say when I say men are as biologically primed to parent as women are. Because you go through the same hormonal shifts to make sure that your focus is on the child and that you are motivated to care for the child.
Okay. So when when guys listen to this and they're thinking, hang on a minute, I've not really felt that inclined to make any gains at the gym in the last little while.
Yeah.
And I'm not making these gains like I was. I'm not lifting what I was. But actually, I quite enjoy going looking for pushchairs and you know, assembling nursery furniture and stuff. Yeah. And I'm quite digging the fact that I'm going to have a baby on the horizon. There's a biological reason for it.
That nesting behavior, and it helps you. And it's also possibly one of the reasons why, as you go forward and you've had your baby, you do start to become less ambitious at work, maybe. And you start to think, actually, I'd prefer to trade this next step up the ladder for spending more time with my kid. And lots of men say after they've had children for the first time, they find themselves like crying at the news more. Partly because they've got a kid now and it kind of maybe, but you know, there's that essential maybe maleness. And some people, obviously, when I speak to sort of audiences about this, you can hear the men groan, going, great, have kids, you know, lose some of your masculinity. But actually the bonus of it is testosterone, when it's high, obscures the effects of oxytocin and dopamine. It hinders their effect. So that drop in testosterone means, first of all, that you feel that oxytocin and dopamine more strongly when you interact with your child. They're bonding hormones. So first of all, dopamine gives you a neurochemical reward. So that's why you feel so joyous when you interact with your child. And the oxytocin is the one that's bonding you partly to your child. So it's really important that that drop not only makes you more motivated, but makes your bonds much stronger with your child. So it's all there. It's all there preparing you to be able to do this job and to bring this child up and help it survive, basically. So that's the really key hormonal change. And we also see lots of changes in the brain. So we've always known for a long time that women experience brain changes when they become mums for the first time. We see exactly the same brain changes in men.
Interesting.
So we see increases in gray and white matter in the brain associated with, for example, empathizing and nurturing and risk detection. And we also see changes in the brain associated with planning and problem solving, which are two really key parenting skills. So your brain actually restructures itself to enable it to help you be good at this job.
That's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. And what I found really interesting was I can tell by the book, because you mentioned it more than once, that you have a bit of a fascination with kind of rough play and the biochemical reaction that goes on.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to spoil this, but this blew my mind because I was like, instinctively, I know this, but I didn't know what was happening under the bonnet to make this happen. So do you want to explain that to me?
That's what I love about it is that, rough and tumble play. So everyone knows what rough and tumble play is. It's that really exuberant, extreme sort of play that you quite often see dads do with their kids. So it's throwing them around, tickling them, wrestling, you know, jumping on the furniture, screaming, you know, it's all really energized, really over the top. There's usually a woman in the corner going, stop it, they need to go to bed. And it's really extreme and it's really important. So in the past, it's kind of got dads that label of being, oh, well, you're the fun parent. But it's critical because it does two things. First of all, men do experience a delay in bonding with their children. Because women give birth, they do get a bit of a head start because childbirth is just a flood of chemicals, which actually evolves in the first place to enable that childbirth to happen, but have actually been co-opted over time to actually be involved in bonding. So things like beta endorphin and oxytocin and dopamine. So she does have a head start. Men have to build their interactions through, build their bond through interaction, through doing things with the baby. And obviously we all know the first weeks of a baby, particularly if your partner's breastfeeding, is very mummy-centered. Mm-hmm. And it can be quite hard for men to get a look in. And so I always prepare my dads and say, you know, do not despair. It will come, but you might experience a bit of a delay in feeling a strong bond. But by 6 months, when you can sort of really start playing with your kid, you're getting lots of lovely stuff back. That's when you really start to build this bond. And rough and tumble play is great because it's so extreme and it's so fast and it involves lots of touch and stuff like that. It's an accelerated way to build a bond because you get an absolute tidal wave of bonding hormones when you're doing it. So it's, in a way, in our world where dads do still spend more time outside the house than mums do, it's a really time-efficient way of doing it. So number one, it's really key for bonding. Secondly, it's key for development. It's the first time you as a dad are starting to introduce your child to the skills they're going to need in the outside world. So it's a give-and-take play. It's reciprocal. And that's starting to build those social relationships where you give and take. And you're reading the other person to see, are they still having fun? Have I gone too far? So you're starting to understand the other perspective. You're starting to deal with challenge because it can be very challenging. It can be very risky. You know, you might hurt yourself. and all of these things are things that dad needs to teach his kid to deal with. So those two things, it's really important. So it's when dads come to me at the end of talks and say, you know, what's the one thing I can do as a dad to help me bond with my child? I'll just say, just play with them. Mm-hmm. You know, just go out and play because that is the most important thing. It is not you as the fun parent. It is not a pointless activity. It is as important as making sure they're wearing, you know, a clean onesie or whatever it might be. It is that important. And so I'm trying to get that message out there that and that natural instinct you have to do that is there because it's evolutionarily important for you to do it.
Yeah. And I can see where that would come into play, where mum's sort of kind of like, actually, no, they're about to go to bed or they've just eaten dinner or.
Yes.
and so, but again, this is exactly what we were saying earlier on. It's kind of, it's aligning yourself with the way you naturally are rather than trying to say, right, we're different and whatever and stuff and that. And I find myself kind of walking across the kitchen and going, look, you just want to lighten up a little bit because we're having some fun here, all right? And so, yeah, exactly, and then that exactly makes the situation even worse.
But you know, it is really, really critical. It's really important. And as I said earlier, though, if you're not, you know, some dads really aren't rough and tumbly people, and that's fine. Do something else with your kid. The reason why it's evolved in the West is because dads tend to be time poor. We actually don't see it in cultures where dads spend most of their time with their children because they have time. And, you know, they're physically in contact with their children much more. So they don't, bizarrely, it hasn't evolved, particularly in those cultures, because they have time. But we, generally in the West, men don't have time. And therefore, we see this behavior.
So it's a way that evolution has found a way
make
to
sure that you get a bond.
Make sure you get a bond. It's like the bonding equivalent.
And you're doing that developmental stimulation you're supposed to do.
So bonding equivalent of speed dating.
Yeah. That's what it is. I'm going to nick that. Yeah.
In terms of, like, I mean, we just spoke about how mum and dad kind of interact in that. How much of that, how much of mum and dad's relationship, you know, I think the answer to this is going to be about how much of an impact does mum and dad's relationship with each other have on their relationship with their children?
Quite a lot. I mean, for a long time, I've kind of campaigned for antenatal courses to include sections on dealing with the parenting relationship before the child arrives, because I think we know that, particularly again for men, because they seem to be, compared to women, much more affected by the health of their marital or whatever it might be relationship than women are going forward, in terms of how successfully we say transition to parenthood, how successfully, how comfortably, how competently they adopt this new identity. And men whose relationships maybe aren't as healthy, aren't as sound, tend to find that much harder to do.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas men who've got a good, strong relationship, a good one with mutual support, you know, very healthy, they tend to find that transition much easier. And we know that the easier you find that transition, obviously the easier you bond with your child, the easier the mechanics of the family go forward. So it's really, really important. I would say, you know, it's more important for that to be taught in the antenatal classes than, you know, I don't know, breathing during childbirth. I mean, it is critical in terms of its long-term effect.
Mm.
And that's why in the book there's a whole chapter on the couple relationship, because I just think it's really key. And particularly, you know, we get those 9 months when we know something monumental. Very rarely in life do you know something as monumental as this is going to happen to you. You've got 9 months in which to really look at that relationship and do some work on it.
Mm.
And there are studies now, they do a brilliant program in the States, which is actually an antenatal course, but it's entirely focused on the couple relationship. And if you look at the results from that in terms of how well those parents go forward, how likely they are, for example, to get postnatal depression, it's amazing. Because, you know, the parenting relationship is the foundational relationship in the family. It's the one upon which all other relationships will be built. It's also the first example of a relationship your child will see.
Mm.
And so for them, learning about relationships and about the social world, the healthier that is, the more that you can model, you know, good conflict resolution behavior. Because, you know, parents are going to argue.
Yeah.
But how do you resolve that?
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you support each other when you disagree? You know, all these things are really important. So I think the parenting relationship is one of the keystones of the family, and therefore it's really important that you work for it to be good. And that's what I said earlier about deciding what you want your roles to be.
Yeah.
You know, get you know, explain who you want to be. Who do you want to be as a dad? How do you see being a father during pregnancy? How does she see being a mother?
Mm.
What are you going to do at 3 o'clock in the morning when the baby's screaming and, you know, nobody's bought any new nappies? Are you going to have a massive argument, or are you going to try and mutually problem solve that and go forward and not blame?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting. I see a lot of parents and well, particularly dads, who have not had the whole roles, boundaries and needs discussion within their own relationship before the pitter patter of tiny feet.
Yeah.
And so they're having to redo that bit a little bit further, further down the line. And in terms of the kind of cross-generational impact that we spoke about earlier on, I think, again, an impact of the kind of baby boomers and the generation after that, you know, it rung a bell when I read in your book about the concept of maternal gatekeeping, because I think that there is characteristics that us as dads carry over from our own fathers, and mums carry on over from their own mums. And you know, me and my wife in the last little while, we've noticed, and you do notice it because you begin to say stuff that your dad used to say, and you hear your wife say stuff that her mum says, and you're like, and it's kind of, it's catching that in a non-judgmental way and saying, I can see what I'm doing here. I mean, I call it breaking the chain. So basically, your parents didn't do a bad job, but there's characteristics that you don't want to carry on with. Yeah. And it kind of, it makes you cringe when you feel those characteristics in yourself. Yeah. And you're like, well, how do I correct that or do this differently? And it takes a level of awareness, but you can get to that level of awareness, I think.
It does. Yeah, you have to be quite mindful. You have to be quite mindful of what you're doing. Exactly. I mean, you know, we all are aware of the bits of parenting that we want to do differently to our parents, however good a job they did.
Mm.
It's being mindful of that. And understand, and as you say, it's a discussion to be had before you have the children. Because once you've got the children, you don't really have time to have the discussion. So, you know, it's really important to do that. And it's something that, you know, with sort of national organisations who run antenatal courses, it's something I'm always saying, you know, please don't give a nod to it for an hour on the second antenatal class. It needs more than that.
Mm. Yeah.
Because it's so important.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the thing is one thing I notice, particularly with dads and men, is that we tend to jump out of a plane with a parachute, but we don't tend to fire the parachute until we're quite close to the ground in terms of things going wrong. And so that sort of becomes a feature. What fascinated me as well reading through was how the impact of, particularly with role models, how the impact of dads shapes young adolescents as they're going to teens and that particular time. And I know that, having done some other reading around this subject, that executive function and it not being kind of fully formed is often why those early teen years, where they're kind of a bit disorganized and a bit sort of all over the place because they've not fully formed that skill. How do dads impact on that phase of time and the development as they go into, you know, into adulthood?
Yeah. Well, I always say, you know, dads are important throughout a child's life, but there are two key points when dads are really important. That one is the preschool age, when they first go into the world beyond the family and go to nursery, preschool, whatever. The other is teenagehood. Because both are transitions into the world beyond the family. Teenagehood is when you're starting to really separate from your parents. Your key attachment figures tend to no longer be your parents. They tend to be your peers. And you're starting to really develop your identity. And we know from the early years preschool studies that, yeah, executive function, for example, the dad seems to be the key parent when it comes to the development of executive function in their child. And we know that from the age of about three, it's really, really critical. So executive function is things like attention, emotional inhibition, things like that. And it's really the fundamental cognitive skills that enable you to interact with other people and be somebody in society. And if you don't get good executive function going forward, you can struggle with mental health, you can struggle with social anxiety and things like that. So really the foundations for how that adolescence is going to be actually occur at preschool level when dads are involved there. But then when we come to adolescence, because adolescence is about moving beyond the family and becoming an independent, autonomous being, again, because dads seem to be the gatekeeper to the world beyond the family, they again seem to become more important in terms of, again, scaffolding that child's entry into the social world, particularly in relation to mental resilience, than mum is. So dads and the relationship they build with their children seems to be more significant, for example, to things like self-esteem, to rates of depression and rates of anxiety in children, in adolescents, than mums are. And we know that it's the interactions that a dad has with their adolescent at that point, which seem to underpin their mental health going well into adulthood. So, you know, there've been studies that have been done and which show that it is, again, it's about interaction, but it's about spending time with your child. So it's really interesting when you ask children how they measure how important they are to their mums and dads. When they look at the mum, they'll say, well, you know, she hugs me. She makes sure I have my favorite breakfast cereal. You know, that's how I know I'm important in love. When you say, how do you know your dad loves you? Because he spends time with me. So in adolescence, scaffolding that resilience is all about spending time with your adolescent. But it's not about acres of time. And it's not about just sitting there on the sofa talking to each other. It's actually about do something with your adolescent. It doesn't actually need to be anything fancy. It can be walking the dog. It could be washing the car. It could be preparing Sunday lunch. Or it can be something you both like to do together. But it gives you, it gives that child the understanding they're important to you, and that gives them self-esteem. But it also allows them to have those conversations in a less intense way they might need to have. So again, with adolescents, you know, dads always say, oh God, what can I do? What can I do to make sure I'm being the best dad I can be? And it's about just find that time, find that activity. And that's what will help. And they really do seem to underpin then that real mental resilience and that ability to be successful going forward in terms of operating in life.
Yeah. And I've experienced that whole guiding and sort of mentoring in the last little while, because, you know, my relationship with my eldest has changed. She's now at secondary school, and, you know, typical conversations are like, you know, when they're beating themselves up and because they want to get stuff right and this kind of being incredibly hard on themselves. Frequently I'll have, you know, sit down and say, look, we're looking for progress here, not perfection, okay? You just try your best, and some days you're going to get it, some days you're not going to get it. Grown-ups have exactly the same things. Sometimes I have bad days, sometimes I have good days. That's part of life.
Exactly.
So it's kind of coaching that emotional intelligence almost, isn't it?
Exactly. It's about understanding, particularly that whole perfection and failure thing, that actually failure is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. It's important to learn how to fail, because you will fail. And we know that kids who have never been seen to fail are the ones that when they come to adulthood really struggle and really can't cope with those obstacles. Whereas if you, as you say, teach your child, say, you're going to come up against stuff, you're going to get things wrong, but as long as you've tried your best, then you're going to be fine. It's going to be fine. You know, and that's the important message to tell children, I think, particularly in this world where perfection seems to be this thing. It's incredibly important to tell them that, you know, it doesn't exist.
See, and now what I've done is I've perfectly segued for your grand finale here, Anna, to talk about the, I think, and I'm going to pronounce this probably wrong, and this is going to be something that maybe pushy parents need to hear, and it's the Chiola study around putting pressure on your kids to achieve.
Yeah.
Do you mind delving into that for me? Because there's certainly, I can probably count on probably more than two pairs of hands, how many parents need to hear this in 2021.
Yeah, so it's a study that shows that if you put a lot of pressure on your child to succeed, so if you coach them and helicopter and do all that and absolutely emphasize to them that anything less than an A is not acceptable, the results show that those children actually get much lower grades than the children where you've got a parent who goes, try your best, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect, but I just want you to have put, you know, as much into it as you can. So somebody who's more realistic will actually get higher grades than somebody who's, so helicopter tiger parenting, all that kind of stuff, is much more likely to lead to failure and lower grades.
There you go. Yeah. So think about that. If you're listening to this or watching this, go away and have a think about that when you're getting some extra tuition in so your kids can get through the 11 plus.
Yes, exactly.
Anna, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today. The book is fantastic. As you've gathered it, there was a lot of kind of bells going off in my head as I was reading through it, not least because it kind of confirms a lot of the stuff that deep down we know to be the case, and instinctively we know to be the case, but I think sometimes parents struggle to trust their instincts and they're looking for something else externally. So it was absolutely fantastic. What is the best way for people to find out about the work that you do, if they want to look into any of these concepts any further? What's the best way for people to reach out?
So I have a website at annamachin.com. Mm-hmm. So if you search that up on Google, and on there, there's lots of podcasts and videos and articles and blogs and all that kind of stuff. I'm on Twitter at Dr. A. Machin. Mm-hmm. So again, look for me on there. And there I sort of tweet about stuff that I'm doing, but also stuff that, you know, colleagues around the world are doing. Mm-hmm. And also research projects that people might want to get involved in that are based on fathering. So I'm pretty much everywhere. So really, go on there and look at the resources. There's also a contact form on the website. So if you do have a question, then feel free to email me.
All right, excellent. And there's one last question I'm going to ask you before I send you on your way. And it's a question that I ask all of my guests on the Guild of Dads podcast, and that is, what is it in life that gives you meaning, Anna?
Crikey, that's heavy, isn't it? What is it that gives me meaning? It is probably the relationships I have. So, relationships I have with my children, with my family, my husband. I think they're probably at the centre of everything.
All right. Excellent. I love it. Thank you very much once again for coming on and speaking to me today. It has been a pleasure. Thank you for the work that you're doing and championing the dad cause, as it were. So keep up the good work, and hopefully I'll speak to you soon.
Excellent. Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Thanks a lot. A big thanks to Anna Machin for talking to me today. I'm very grateful to her for sharing her experience, expertise and insight with me. You can catch Anna over on Twitter, and her website is annamachin.com, which is annamachin.com. There's a ton of resources on there, and there's also some links to her TED Talk and also another video series that she has done on love and relationships. The book we mentioned is called Life of Dad, The Making of the Modern Father, and I'll link all this up in the show notes along with all the other stuff we discussed over at guildofdads.com. I was really pleased to speak to Anna today because, as I mentioned, evolution and how we've adapted is a particular area of interest to me. Sometimes I think that the role of dads is minimised in some respects and also to a certain degree belittled in wider culture today. Therefore, it was very insightful to find out the biology which underpins the very real role dads play in children's upbringing and the family unit. What was particularly resonating for me was the fact that a lot of this stuff instinctively we know is going on under the bonnet, if you like, but we just don't know what is actually happening in terms of the biological processes that are going on inside us. The most amazing things were around hormonal changes in preparation for birth and also bonding, the impact of mum and dad's relationships, and the unique role that dads play. This conversation that I had with Anna has solidified my conviction that outside of the relationship with yourself, the other one worth investing in is with the mother of your children, and of course, your children themselves. There's also a video of this interview over on the Guild of Dads YouTube channel, and you can link up with me over on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook using the handle @GuildofDads. I'm teaching you how to follow a simple system and plan, just like many of my guests, in order to transform all areas of your life so that you can live more purposefully with much greater fulfillment and meaning, at the same time as becoming the man and dad you always wanted to be. It's all in my ebook, The Dad Blueprint. You can grab it over free at guildofdads.com/dad. That's guildofdads.com/dad. Now, in order to have a positive impact on the world, we improve ourselves and inspire others to do the same. The fee for this show, if you've enjoyed listening today, is that you share it with others so that they may benefit from anything you find useful or interesting. If you know someone that could do with improving their relationships, could do with a life rethink or different perspective, share this episode with them. The best bit, you don't have to tell them why you're sharing it with them, but it could be just what they need to hear. I'm going to ask you a big favour as well today, and that is, can you leave me a rating and review on iTunes if you listen through iTunes or Apple Podcast? I know from the statistics that I'm getting through that more and more of you guys are tuning in each week, and the download and listen numbers are growing week on week. So I thank you if you're an existing listener, and I also welcome you if you're a new listener. Thank you to you guys for making Guild of Dads and the podcast what it is. I want to continue to grow this, and it's dependent on sharing the podcast, sharing the movement, sharing what I'm doing with as many people as you can. So that is all I ask of you. Hopefully you find something insightful in every episode. So like I say, share with dads you know. And in the meantime, live a life of vision, action, and meaning. Apply what you hear, and we'll see you next time.